everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Perception Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This week's session was an Exploring Individual Rights Part 2. With a semi-present myself and Joe, we have to admit, a little bit worse for wear, and too much coffee isn't a good combination.
Yeah, we got called out, didn't we, as well, early on. Yeah. So we had to own up to it.
People yeah, I'm know, not sure if that'll be not. In the recording or not, but...
yeah, people know, don't they, that we're not up to our normal selves for some reason. They know us too well now, Jasmine.
Yeah, and I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that it is a free podcast.
Yeah, if you want us to come here not hungover, then you're going to have to pay a premium, unfortunately.
Yeah, straight. I'll give you my banking details.
Yeah, not to the company, to us directly.
Anyway, we carried on where we left off last time, talking about the assumption of reasonableness when it comes to health professionals, social workers and education workers as well, in relation to disclosing third-party data as part of a SAR, and how that can be appropriate in some instances, because it's something that people aren't really aware of. And we were sent an email as well by someone who I wouldn't say counteracted it, but had a situation with a FOIA request where they did withheld health professionals' data. So we unpacked that. We spoke about, you know, the effect of the principles on data subject rights, and how data subject rights don't just, you know, cover those within the GDPR, they extend further than that. So we unpicked a little bit around that as well. What were your highlights, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've covered everything, to be honest, but I think you did a really good job, Jasmine, explaining kind of you explained the difficulties around the Data Protection Act and the Freedom of Information Act, and kind of, you know, gave a really good or used a really good example to kind of bring that to life. So I thought that was really, really good. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, I wanted to kind of explore how compliant with the principles of data protection will have impacts on rights requests, or it could have impacts on rights requests. So yeah, listen out for those two. I think they're really two yeah. really good discussions as part of this.
Yeah, we had someone on mute as well and ask about in what situations can you withhold information that basically relates to two people, and it's by no means simple, by every means complicated, I would say. So there was a little bit on SARS towards the end of the session as well, and yeah, it's a tricky area to navigate, including when you tie into that Data Protection Act as well. So it was a lot to unpack today. But we hope you enjoyed the session. And, you know, if you want to inquire further about what we can do to help you with SARS, then let us know. Drop us an email at info@dataprotectionpeople.com, or just any rights requests. You know, we can advise on specific situations, because we know ourselves how complicated it can get. And no request is the same. But yeah, without further ado, please enjoy the session. And we'll be back next week for a GDPR radio.
Quite a couple of big news stories as well. I kind of want to start around the Ministry of Defence that has been hacked, and there's been reports that it was China, although I think that's unconfirmed. But supposedly that all serving members of the armed forces bank details may have been compromised following a hack of third party payroll system used by the Ministry of Defence. Ministry of Defence source told ITV News that the hack happened in recent days and it hit a network that was completely external to core systems. They said that they acted very swiftly when they discovered the breach by taking the external network offline. The details of all serving personnel, reservists and a small number of veterans have been impacted, including the names, bank details and in a small number of cases, their personal addresses. Reports suggested that China was behind the attack, but the government is not yet pinning the blame on Beijing. So that's something that we're going to have to keep an eye on, I believe, because that could have some real serious consequences. And I guess kind of the thing that Michael's actually just put in the chat, said, do we know who the third party is? I do not currently know, Michael. I'm not sure if anyone listening knows who it is. But it's been quite a common theme, hasn't it, actually, over the past 18 months or so, that big organisations have kind of having breaches, and it's not necessarily down to their own kind of infrastructure. It's third party access that's kind of been letting them down. And I just think it kind of reiterates the point of how important it is to, you know, carry out due diligence and have processes in place to mitigate, you know, risk such as this, and why it's so important to kind of, you know, be wise of the third party that you engage with, you know, especially when an organization such as the Ministry of Defence, it's slightly ironic that they have such a big data breach, isn't it?
Yeah, it reminds me. So yesterday we had a meeting with an organization, a potential partner, about data loss prevention. So they provide managed services and everything in relation to data loss prevention, to be honest. And their mantra was, you know, if you think that you're not getting hacked, and, you know, you say, oh, we've not been hacked, it's fine, we're not interested, chances are you just don't know about it. And it reminded me of, you know, if an organization says, oh, we don't have a breach, we've never had a breach, that kind of thing, then it's the same principle. Obviously, normally, probably on a lesser scale. I mean, maybe not. You know, it's two things, security and data protection, that are very closely related. So maybe not to this scale necessarily, but it probably is a common, very common thing, more so than each organization individually believes or is aware of.
Yeah, I completely agree. And kind of just going back to your point about when organizations say that they don't have we don't have many personal data breaches, I think that says more about their ability to identify personal data breaches than kind of, you know, are they actually having breaches, or, you know, are they just struggling to, you know, identify breaches that have been occurring and they're just, you know, they're not aware of. Rebecca's left a comment saying, how would one distinguish between an incident and a data breach, or is it semantics? Well, an incident is a security incident, and then a data breach is defined as a security incident that then leads to, please don't pull me upon this, but it's like unauthorized disclosure of access to personal data. So the data breach is the security incident that leads to the then subsequent unauthorized loss, alteration, etc., of personal data. So that's just the difference between an incident and a personal data breach.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if a security incident is defined necessarily, but that's how we would differentiate, at least. I'm not sure. Maybe you could confirm that, Joe.
I don't think so. Not off the top of my head. I mean, we see
it's a breach of security, isn't it? In the definition, that's it.
And we see it as confidentiality, don't we? Integrity and availability of the data. So kind of around like the technical and organizational measures, you know, has it been, you know, has there been a breach of confidentiality? You know, is the data still available, or is it, you know, is it no longer accessible? So I guess that's kind of the sort of things that I'd probably look at in terms of whether something is considered a security incident. But it's quite a tricky thing to navigate, isn't it? And it's something I think that some people do struggle with, definitely.
Yeah. And on the topic of, you know, security incidents and hacks, so I don't know if you saw that NHS Dumfries and Galloway was subject to a cyber attack in March, which was confirmed that hackers were able to access a significant quantity of data, including patient and staff identifiable information. So the cyber criminals later released a proof pack which included confidential information on a small number of patients and warned more would follow. So in an update on Monday, the health board confirmed that a large volume of data had been published, and Julie White, the chief executive of the NHS Dumfries and Galloway, branded it an utterly abhorrent criminal act. So yeah, not great.
No, sorry,
you're getting that call through.
Slight technical difficulties again with our phone system coming through my ears as I'm on the podcast. So sorry about that, Jasmine. But yeah, it's worrying stuff, isn't it? Again, you know, news stories of you know, public sector organisations being in, you know, quite a bit of bother in relation to personal data breaches. And I imagine we won't see any sort of monetary penalty notice from the ICO off the back of their public sector approach of it's a waste of taxpayers' money. But he's still highlighting this, though, isn't it? That there's issues here, and I think it's a lot deeper than probably what we realise. And I think the ICO, if as a regulator, if they're not going to fine these organisations, then they have to do something. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're doing something. It doesn't seem like they're doing anything. I don't know if anyone listening here kind of has an indication or, you know, has seen the sort of things that they're doing. But yeah, it's worrying, isn't it? These news stories of NHS organisations, you know, constantly cropping up in the news about people's data being breached. It's it really is quite worrying, obviously, given the sensitivity of the data that's at stake.
Yeah, I think obviously it's that, like you say, the sensitivity of it. It's going to be, you know, more common that they have serious breaches in relation to another organisation in terms of the scale of the breach. But in some ways, I almost feel sorry for them, because it's a hard thing to constantly combat and prevent, and especially as technology is evolving, is it a matter of, you know, pure negligence on that organization's part, or is it the struggle to keep up with, you know, the technological advancements of hackers and that kind of thing? You know, where does that lie in it?
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually, and it's probably not something that I've ever considered. You know, with NHS being public funded, you know, they don't really make any money, do they, really? So how are they able to kind of fund decent infrastructure that kind of is in a better place for them to, you know, warn off hackers? I just, you know, you're right, Jasmine, it's a very good point. Although, and I'm not kind of just saying that it's all going to be because of that, because, you know, as we saw early in the year when NHS staff tried to access Kate's personal health information, it will be a mixture of kind of poor kind of systems or not up to scratch systems that can contribute or kind of back off hackers, and then it will be on the other side as well, probably staff's due diligence or you know, poor processes and policies in place.
And phishing attempts, I think, is probably one of the biggest ways as well, you know, the biggest things.
Yeah, definitely. Anything else that you've seen in the news at all?
I saw an article about the UK government again and data breaches again, saying that the UK government departments have potentially put the information of over 10,000 customers at risk. So the findings came from Apricorn, a manufacturer of hardware encrypted USB USB drives based on a compilation of annual Freedom of Information responses. So the figures revealed statistics regarding breaches reported to the Information Commissioner's Office by HM Revenue and Customs during 2023. And according to the company, HMRC's declaration of 18 breach reports underscores the gravity of the situation. So the sensitive data housed by the department ranges from personally identifiable information to financial details such as tax and benefit records. Of particular note is the significant increase in breaches reported by the DVLA, which escalated from 19 incidents in 2021 to 278 in 2023. So the article says that the surge suggests vulnerabilities within the governmental security protocols requiring urgent attention and remediation, which is true. But at the same time, I don't know if the surge purely comes from, you know, I suppose a dip in their data protection measures and security measures, or whether it's just the reporting's improved. I don't know. But yeah, either way, it's alarming.
That's a very good point, actually, about kind of maybe the organization's ability to recognize a breach has increased, and therefore, you know, it has then led to more breaches being reported because more have been identified, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, the number of breaches is concerning, but it's good that the organization can spot a breach and, you know, are doing the proper process in reporting these breaches. And obviously, got to bear in mind that these organizations, the data that's probably going to be breached will be probably quite sensitive, I'd have thought, which is obviously more likely to cause a risk to the rights and freedoms, and therefore you'll be required to report it to the ICO. A couple of comments in the chat Rachel said that, or if there's a potential change in assessment as to what constitutes a reportable breach. Yes, possibly. It can be quite a tricky thing, can't it, to kind of weigh up whether something is likely to cause a risk, or sorry, is unlikely to cause a risk, and therefore you aren't required to report it. But, you know, again, it's kind of in your processes, isn't it, and your policies of how you go through that process and identify whether a breach is likely to result in a risk. Dave's also left quite an amusing comment in the chat. It's a story actually from the BBC, and it was a free bottle of wine was hidden in website terms and conditions to experiment as to whether anyone would actually read the terms, and if you did, then you'd get a free bottle of wine. I don't know if that's still going. If it is, I might have to have a little look on that this afternoon to get myself a free bottle of wine. But yeah,
get yourself through to payday.
That's really quite amusing, isn't it? Because how often do we actually read terms and conditions? I'll hold my hand up and say I don't think I've ever read terms and conditions. And the same goes for privacy policies. I think I'm more inclined to do so now since I've been working in data protection. But kind of before.
Well, you say that. I'm going to call you out. Yeah, you did ask. I have to read my tenancy agreement before I enter into it. But anyway, moving on.
You cut out a little bit there, and I'm quite glad. But
yeah. Oh, no. Basically, I said, no, I'm joking. Is there anything else you want to cover before we go into the main part of the session? I swear, did you see something on the DPDI bill?
Well, I did see something on the DPDI bill, and I don't know if it's necessarily news because it seemed more of an opinion than a news story, but I came across a post from a gentleman called Chris Pounder, who works in data protection. And he posted on LinkedIn that the DPDI bill finished grand committee stage at Lords and is currently awaiting the report stage on the floor of the House of Lords. So amendments can be made probably by the end of May/early June. The DPDI bill goes into what he said was ping pong, which I imagine is quite a lot of back and forth of this is what we want to do. And OK, you need to make these changes, make the changes right now, go away and make these changes. But anyway, yeah, he mentioned that royal assent could possibly happen before summer recess in July, unless Rishi falls on his sword and calls a general election. So I just kind of wanted to raise that as a point, simply because, it's hard to say whether that's true or not, but I think it's absolutely something that we should all be keeping an eye on, as we come towards summer recess. So yeah, just thought I'd worth mentioning that, and thanks for reminding me.
I'm hoping that there's so many changes that they need to make that it will just keep going on until it just gets dismissed. But it's wishful thinking, maybe, by the sounds of it. But we'll see.
Either way, it's going to be interesting, isn't it, over the next couple of months, kind of the route that it takes. Does it get royal assent? And then if it does get royal assent, is there going to be a lot of backlash? And I imagine there will be quite a bit. Many practitioners have voiced their opinions online, haven't they, about how they're not for the bill. So yeah, it's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Now I think we should get into the main part of the session. And I wanted to pick up where we left off last time. So I didn't really have much time to delve into it, but I spoke about the third party exemption under the Data Protection Act, which is Schedule 2. And as most people will know, if someone puts in a subject access request, then there are certain exemptions that apply, the third party exemption being one of them. So information that relates to other people can be withheld unless the individual has consented to the disclosure, or it's reasonable to disclose the information without the consent. Now, the part that I touched on was under Section 17 of Schedule 2 of the Data Protection Act. And there's this assumption of reasonableness for health workers, social workers, and education workers. Now, this means that if the health data test or social work data or education data test is met, which is under Schedule 3 of the Act, then information relating to health workers, social workers, and education workers can be disclosed. Now, this is if the information is requested, the information in question is contained in a health record and the other individual is a health professional who has compiled or contributed to the health record, or who is in his or her capacity as a health professional and has been involved in the diagnosis, care or treatment of the data subject. Now, this is something that not many people are aware of, so I wanted to delve into it a little bit further. But we actually received an email from someone who's, I assume, is listening. I can't check. And he works for an NHS organisation and sent an email across to say that the information. So let me read the email out. So I've listened to the Individual Rights podcast, and there was a part near the end where I brought up a case where an individual requested the name of a doctor who carried out an assessment for assisted living. That was an example I gave last week, which was about a housing association. So this was disclosed and thought to be okay due to an exemption under the DPA. This is similar to a situation in the company I work for. We received a request for the GMC number of a doctor, which I believe is like the registration number, who carried out a medical assessment. You can look up a name using a GMC. However, in this case, we refused it, citing FOIA under Section 40. The requester appealed to the ICO, who sided with us in withholding it. And then he sent a link to the decision notice. So my initial thoughts with this were, it seems to, you know, you seem to have two contradicting pieces of legislation here. Under FOIA, you can withhold this information. But if this individual put a SAR request in, then, you know, he'd be entitled to it. It didn't really make sense to me. And as my brain always does, I'm sure everyone can attest to this, my head spiraled thinking all the things that might relate to it and, you know, which rabbit hole am I choosing to go down because there were multiple ones. But to give you some background to this request in which the ICO gave a decision. So the complainant made a request for the vaccine damage payment scheme medical assessor's GMC number. So within the NHS, so this was relating to damage caused by I don't know if it's any vaccine or the COVID vaccine or what. I assume maybe any vaccine.
I think it's any, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I think there was an assessment. I don't know if it was on, you know, a broad level or individual. I assume individual thinking about it as to whether there's been, you know, damage or harm to the individual, any side effects, that kind of thing, because they could be owed compensation. So the complainant made a request for the medical assessor's GMC number, qualifications and experience, and a copy of the vaccine damage payment scheme's guidance the medical assessors follow. So the NHS authority provided the VDPS guidance the medical assessors follow with some redactions which are not in dispute. And it is confirmed it does not hold. So the NHS authority confirmed it does not hold the medical assessor's qualifications, experience, and it was withheld the medical assessor's GMC numbers under Section 40, subsection 2 of FOIA. Now, the ICO's opinion. So going back to the, exception, you know, the assumption of reasonableness under Section 17 of Schedule 3 of the Data Protection Act, if the doctor or health professional's details are on that health record, then it should be disclosed. However, the ICO's opinion in this case were that while medical assessors are GMC registered doctors, they provide an assessment on the medical evidence from doctors or hospitals involved in the treatment of those claimants who have been injured by vaccinations, the medical assessors are not providing diagnosis, care or treatment when it comes to making assessments in respect of the VDPS. So records made by the assessors are not health records within the meaning of the Data Protection Act. So that doesn't apply here, but does that mean that it should be disclosed under FOIA? And obviously in this case it doesn't, because it is personal data. But I was intrigued as to why, you know, what their justification was for that, because they explained it within it. So under Section 42, and I don't know about you, Joe, but I don't really deal with FOIA that much. I have dealt with it in the past, and you know, I do know there are exemptions relating to personal data, but you know, it was a bit of learning for myself as well.
I'm not particularly well versed in FOIA either, I have to admit.
Yeah. Well, under Section 40, Subsection 2 of FOIA, information is exempt from disclosure if it is personal data of an individual other than the requester, and where one of the conditions listed under Subsection 3A, 3B, or 4A is satisfied. So in this case, they looked at Section 43A, Subsection A. It's quite hard to follow. But this applies where the disclosure of the information to any member of the public will contravene any of the principles relating to the processing of personal data. So, you know, those under Article 5. And in this case, they started off with the first principle, fair, lawful and transparent processing, and looked towards lawful processing. So I thought this still relates to this session because they looked into legitimate interest and undertook a legitimate interest assessment. So first identifying a legitimate interest, which the individual would have on a personal and a public level, you know, in terms of NHS activities, especially with damages caused to an individual by a vaccination. So that was satisfied. And then subsequently, whether the disclosure or whether the processing is necessary for that legitimate interest. But the main part here was the balancing of the, you know, the other individual's fundamental freedoms and rights compared to the legitimate interest that complainant had. And in this case, they decided that it was insufficient to, there was an insufficient legitimate interest essentially to outweigh the data subject's fundamental rights and freedoms, as the disclosure could cause distress, and you know, you don't know what that individual wants to do with that information, and that doctor, you know, it's private to them, that they shouldn't be entitled to it essentially. But it was an example of you know, comparing the rights and freedoms of an individual against another one, really.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jasmine. That was a really good and quite complicated explanation of, you know, real life scenarios that, you know, I'm sure many in the chat kind of come across. Matthew, who sent it in, is actually sat here listening. He did let us know as you started to explain that. So yeah, really thanks for sending that in, Matthew. And I guess kind of that, what that does to me anyway, is highlights how bloody difficult it can be to kind of step through some of the, you know, the legislation that we work with every day. I mean, the Data Protection Act is a real pain, isn't it? Because it's all over the place. It sends you here, there, and everywhere, and it seems FOIA does the same as well. So yeah, I think you did a really good job of explaining that, and a really
tried.
Good, yeah, tried. may have lost me a point or two.
if I've lost you, I've lost everyone. That's no good. But yeah, essentially, you know, in terms of rights available, you've got to weigh up. It's not just one person versus an organisation. You know, it can be two people's rights pitted against each other, and you've got to do those balancing tests to ensure that you are protecting people at the end of the day. And it's just not a simple process, but then bringing in, you know, two different pieces of legislation can complicate matters further. And like you say, you know, you've really got to navigate your way around these legislations to figure it out. And it's not smooth sailing, to say the least, especially on a bit of a hangover, but
no, so it was your point was interesting though, kind of around, you know, does FOIA contradict the Data Protection Act? Did you explain in there why it doesn't? Sorry, I should have been listening really, but
I apologise to everyone listening in for our slowness today. But yeah, essentially the assessment wasn't deemed a health record. It didn't meet the definition of a health record in this instance, so that didn't, you know, that exemption under the Data Protection Act didn't apply in this instance. So regardless of, you know, the assumption of reasonableness and all of that, just put that to one side, even though it is something that is definitely worth making everyone aware of. On, you know, on a side note, when it comes to dealing with SARS, obviously this was a FOIA request. So then going into FOIA, you can't, you know, public authorities and those caught by FOIA do have to disclose records that they hold, but there are exemptions that apply, and one of the exemptions is personal data in specified instances, and this was one of those, to summarize.
Okay, yeah, great, thanks for that, Jasmine.
No, it's okay.
as you mentioned as well there, kind of, you know, when you're dealing with rights and relying on lawful basis and, you know, legitimate interest, for example, you often have to weigh up, don't you, the individual's rights and freedoms against, you know, the interests of the organisation typically. And kind of something that I just kind of want to touch on brief. I don't really want to go into too much detail about it, but I think it's worth mentioning that I think rights and freedoms is a lot wider than kind of just your data protection rights. So when you're kind of looking at, okay, this processing, how will it impact the rights in terms of, you know, right to access, erasure, rectification, and so on, it's also a lot wider, isn't it? It's also looking at basic human rights that come under the Human Rights Act. And I don't think it's something that often gets kind of the attention that it probably deserves. And I think if you probably looked wider at the Human Rights Act, I think people would probably start to understand, okay, so these are the sort of risks, you know, any of these rights here that people have, what could this processing impact any of these rights? So, for example, in there, there's kind of things around like the right to respect for private and family life, and there's things around the prohibition of discrimination and the restrictions on political activity and aliens, apparently. And I kind of just wanted, yeah, I don't know if it means those sort of aliens, but it does say aliens, I promise you. But I kind of just wanted to make the point because I think it's overlooked more often than not. And kind of when I was going through the Human Rights Act, actually, as for some prep for this, it kind of, I don't know, like a light bulb switched. It's probably dropping myself in it again, but I kind of started to realize why certain data is considered special category, because, you know, it's some of the data that, you know, could be in the wrong person's hand is, you know, likely to cause a higher risk to people's rights and freedoms and therefore requires further protections, such as Article 9 lawful basis, for example. So yeah, it was just a bit of a thing that I just kind of wanted to mention, really.
Yeah, it's funny because it's something that just, you know, can easily go over your head when you think of data subject rights. You think of SARs and erasure requests and so on, but the purpose of data protection legislation and GDPR is to protect people's fundamental rights and freedoms, which these are. You know, it's a way of navigating such protection through the digital world, really, and past that, you know, obviously it includes physical records and whatnot, but especially as we go into more of a digital age, that like it's more important than ever.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree.
Yeah. And so during the week I was talking to Laura, and she was saying about how they received a SAR from a small local council where one of the councillors and one of the staff members had a fallen out, and this has resulted in three SARs being received by with both of them basically trying to find out what the other one has said about the other, you know, each other. And it just got me thinking, you know, these rights are available to people to protect them, and for complete transparency and whatnot, but is trying to, you know, putting in a subject access request to find out what someone else has said, that's not really, you know, the purpose of why these are why these rights have been provided, and you know, is it abuse of rights, is could you call it that?
It's a very good point, and I understand completely what you're saying, because, you know, the right gives you access to your information, and if someone has been communicating about you, then, you know, you do have access to that. But you're right in what you say, that the right is kind of there for you to understand what data an organization processes about you and what they're doing with it. And kind of that's the purpose of having the right of access, right, as opposed to trying to find out if a coworker has, you know, been slagging you off to another one. Yeah. So yeah, it's it could possibly be classed as, I guess, as an abuse of your rights, but I think that would be quite difficult to prove, I'd probably say.
We'll see it in the DPDI bill next week, just you wait.
What, abuse of the powers?
Yeah, but I think that's a common issue with especially employee SARs. You know, it's usually down to a disgruntled rather than, you know, actually just wanting to know why their information is being collected and how it's being used. It's I suppose that's where it gets a bit tricky with when it comes down to opinions of people, and obviously why an organization should do their best to minimize that on, you know, work channels.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Yeah, I had another conversation as well with a customer of mine called Claire. She works for a charity, and she handles, like, you know, data protection and information security and SARS specifically as well. And she always, you know, she was saying, like, you know, people put in SARS for this reason and it's a waste of time because they don't find what they're looking for, etc. And she was saying that, she, you know, she complains to the head of HR for this. And basically, there was a disgruntle with the head of HR who ultimately put in a subject access request. But then she was worried that, you know, she's going to have to see really sensitive information by looking through her documents and, you know, redacting them appropriately, and frankly she didn't want to know. You know, ignorance is bliss in some instances. But that's, you know, it really got me thinking about another side to subject access requests. If somebody high up is to make a SAR, then someone has to read that and go through it and see all this confidential information that they otherwise wouldn't be entitled to. And, you know, it takes that conversation we had last time about what is the role of the DPO in terms of the organization and the individual. It takes it to a whole new level, you know, because there's such sensitive information involved. But it how do you manage that, really? I don't know if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good question. And you're right. I think the only way that you can kind of stay partial, I guess, is if you outsource it to companies like us, I guess. No, jokes aside, it's a very good point, Jasmine. And it's, and that's probably where SARS can get quite tricky, isn't it? Kind of, you know, is there a conflict of interest of you as a role of a DPO and also as an employee of that organization? Especially if it's higher up above you, you know, you could be finding things out that, like you said, that you're not otherwise entitled to, or the company don't want you to find out. So, yeah, because you've got to go through that process, haven't you, of reading it all in order to redact the information that's not necessary. So I don't really think I've answered your question, but Rachel's got a hand up. She had it up for about 5 minutes. So thanks for being patient, Rachel. But if you want to unmute and jump in, by all means, please do.
Thank you. All been really interesting. Thank you. I just wanted to go back to the disgruntled employee type SAR, where somebody, so we obviously, every organisation, I think, has those. I just wondered what the position is where you can obviously put in to ask what somebody has written about you and you would get those opinions back. How do people feel about sharing the impact of somebody's behavior on somebody else on the team? Because we tend to not provide that because it is how it's impacting somebody else who's not the data subject. It's their, you know, it's their situation, if you like, but it's absolutely driven in a hypothetical example, absolutely driven by the behavior or values of the data subject. So they only tend to get back what somebody said about them, but not see the context of what their behavior may have caused that has led that person to say what they've said. And I just would really welcome your advice on how to handle something like that.
So do you mean almost like the events that lead up to it, or the events following that opinion?
No, so the events that's sort of led up. So just for example, if it was me and Joe working together, it's me saying Joe's really making me stressed with the fact he's not turning up at work on time all the time, and I'm having to pick up his work, and it's, you know, my health's really suffering, and it's a lot about me and my health and my stress that obviously we're not going to share because that's not Joe's information. So all he gets is me going, Joe's driving me mad. He doesn't turn up on work on time, but not maybe realizing why it's driving me mad or whatever the situation is, because you haven't got any of that context, because that's my health information and my stress that's being caused. I just think people tend to, they get what they've asked for in terms of they get people's opinions of them, but they don't get the context or actually maybe the impact of what's happening. And is that the way everybody else is dealing with it? Because we obviously go privacy first and don't want to expose somebody else's health situation in a SAR, obviously.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And in some ways, one that I have considered before, but then in other ways, I've never considered, you know, them not having the context around a negative opinion. But at the same time, I have been involved in SARs where you do have to redact everything around it, and context is probably a common issue in general, whether it's an opinion or something else, because, you know, you receive a SAR back that's heavily redacted and it doesn't mean anything to you. You know, you're just seeing like your name pop up here and there. I think the ICO advises, you know, that where appropriate, it's to provide some context around it so it makes sense. And, you know, in some instances, it's probably, you know, you've got to consider that individual, the other individual's stress and context of why they're saying that and where it's come from, and maybe see the bigger picture and just don't disclose it. But then at other times, I don't think you could say that with confidence that, oh, because they're saying it for, you know, their own disgruntled reasons, that you have to disclose it and that you have to withhold it. So obviously, you know, it doesn't help, but it might depend on the situation. Sometimes I try to refrain from saying that because it's not always necessarily helpful, but there might be instances where considering that other individual more so, it's appropriate to withhold it. But mostly don't take that as a one size fits all.
Sorry, Jasmine. Mostly when it's, yeah. Mostly when you're looking at employees, you've got to look at confidentiality and the expectation of confidentiality and the appropriateness, as you've said. And with employees, if there's been an impact, it's likely that you're not going to have the consent from the other individual to release that information. And it won't be reasonable, likely under the circumstances, to release that. So you'd be looking to exclude that impact under third party.
Yeah, if the individual is identifiable from it, definitely. Yeah. I think there are some instances, you know, if you take out certain information like emails and identifiable identifiers, then, you know, you might not be able to identify who said that. But then at the same time, really err on the side of caution, because the third party exemption extends to where you can identify the source of that information. So if, you know, if it's obvious that it was Joe saying that about you, yeah, because it's only you two that are in the office, then you should withhold that, because that will, you know, reveal who said that information, even if it's in, you know, a certain way. If it's an email and not, you know, you get the odd person who might put a kiss at the end of the email, it's not a common thing, but if that's obvious, then, you know, you probably should withhold things like that as well. So
yeah, if you've got 12 people that are impacted in the same way, you're not going to be able to identify that were particular person from those 12 people having the same impact. But likely with employees or with tenancy disputes, it's going to be two people impacting each other through a tit for tat.
Thank you, Laura. Does that help, Rachel?
She said thanks in the
yeah.
Comments.
Oh, okay. That's perfect. that's just gone through exactly what we discussed. I feel really reassured now that we're doing this right. So thank you.
Good. Yeah, no problem. Laura, I'm going to put you on the spot here while you're
on this. Oh, no.
So obviously, you know, you're our SAR manager and you're very well fed with all sorts of weird and wonderful SARs. What would you say, you know, and with your experience in mind, what would you say the most difficult parts of the subject access request are? Obviously, you know, everyone's different and that can be difficult in and of itself. But, you know, do you have any things that even you might still struggle with that come up from time to time?
Each type of SAR has its own complexities. So you've got social services SARs where you've got care. Those can be really complex, not just reading it and seeing the content, but kind of disseminating where you've got, particularly got social services involved, whose data you're withholding at different points, because there's different rules around all of that. I think for me, it's third party is a really difficult one, because you've got the boundaries of confidentiality around that. And it's knowing how to assess the situation and how to apply that rule and doing all that background calculation in essence.
Yeah, I remember dealing with a social care SAR once, and it was the daughter who, well, there was seven children and then the parents, but I think the children had been in care through most of the life, and one of the girls had put in a SAR, and there was a lot, obviously, that related to issues that she'd had with her parents. But obviously, they're her issues. And there's also that level of, you know, having to consider what she's already aware of in disclosing certain information. But then you really need to be careful not to disclose that one tiny snippet that she might not be aware of, or that doesn't necessarily, it, you know, it might relate to her, but it's you know, weighs more in favour of the parents. And it's so, so difficult because it's just social care records, you know, record after record as well. So everything's so intrinsic. It's it's a difficult one.
Yeah, it is. And I think what I find challenging now, as opposed to what I found, because I did these obviously when I was internal as well. So as Fiona said, when you're internal and you've got employee SARs that you're sort of reviewing, you've got to be independent and knowing the characters that's involved usually.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys touched on earlier the use of SARs, and I've never found a SAR that's been used in a genuine way. I've always found them to be weaponized use of their legislation and their rights to obtain information about them through discreet or non-discreet means, particularly when they feel like they've been hard done by. Yeah. And I think independence in that process is really difficult, particularly if you're involved in the dispute around what's occurred there.
Yeah. It's funny, sometimes you'll receive a request and it's like, I want communications between X and Y.
Yeah.
Between the updates. It's like, well,
that's
you
not try. What the right's for.
Yeah.
But yeah, from this side, it's context, because you don't have it. You don't know what they've seen. You don't know what they've been privy to. So you just have to make a judgment call and provide the right calculations behind the scenes to make sure that the client that we're working with has got the right framework to get past the ICO if it gets to that stage.
And what's your stance on business as usual data? So to explain that, that might be personal data that involves the requester, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, it might be within a work capacity.
Yeah, so if the employees sent a load of emails in their capacity as the role they were in or maybe in still, that is all business as usual. So that's information they've sent in the course of their business. Where you've got phrases like, thank God it's Wednesday, or thank God it's hump day, that's all business as usual text. So the only thing you'd be looking to release is any information about the individual rather than emails from themselves. So I think there's always difficulties when you send the information back to the person that's requested it. You actually find that you could have had 900 documents and only three lines of that is going to be releasable information.
Mm. I remember we had a SAR once where it was the requester worked in a school and they were CC'd into all sorts of information. Yeah. The size of, you know, the file size of that information search was just ridiculous. But then luckily it was, you know, being with our platform, we can reduce.
Yeah,
massively business as usual data.
Yeah, it's a good bit of software that we've got, and the thousands of pages you can get rid of just in 10, 15 minutes.
It's worth explaining that, actually. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. This isn't a sales pitch, but part of our process is to, you know, bulk remove business as usual data, so information that doesn't relate, and, you know, emphasis on relate to the individual. So you've got to be careful in how you go about this, and, you know, ensure that you don't remove personal data that the individual will be entitled to. But at the same time, you know, it does massively reduce searches of you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands records or whatever it might be. But it's a vital part to some SARs, you know, that are just absolutely massive. It's like, once I've probably mentioned it on here, but it always sticks with me. We had an individual who requested, put in a subject access request, and they wanted the information search to include their name, you know, the job role and their initials. Well, their initials were NO. So you can imagine the amount of times NO's come up. It was honestly over a million. It was ridiculous. Yeah,
the software's great. It's called Nuix, for everyone in the chat that's asking. There's a couple of ways of doing it. The Nuix itself has an inbuilt tool that will dedupe, which means deduplicate anything in the system. So it removes anything it sees as a duplicate of another document, which is a massively helpful tool. And then you can plug in information in the background that relates to the particular individual, so their numbers, their names. From that, then you can see how many what's known as hits in the system that each document has. So you can then go, okay, well, this person's only mentioned once. You go in and you can see that loads of those emails that they've sent. So there's different ways of then doing that, and you can take you've got document counts in there, and you can go, okay, I know that's going to be massive emails. you've also got tools in the facility, in the system, that will show you where duplicates are. So you can see where similar email threads have happened, and you can just instantly then just mass, what's known as mass coding, where you just select a load of documents and you can code them into not relevant and leave a mass comment on those as BAU or not relevant. So it's a really good bit of kit.
Yeah, I think it's really important as well for, you know, so you'll receive, your provider SAR once completed to an individual, and chances are, you know, they'll come back and query things and yeah, question you, potentially complain to the ICO. So to have a record of what you've redacted and why and what exemptions yeah, you've applied is a really good step, to be honest.
Yeah, all the comments and fields that we use all pull through to an Excel spreadsheet that runs off at the end with all the documents. Yeah. So you can, there's that clear. One of the biggest things the ICO look at is your audit trail, from where you pull the information off the system with the search terms you've used to what you've sent out, and any logic that you've used to apply any exemptions or remove the information completely in the process. So the system allows you to do that in a really concise, easy way. So when you face, if you do face that challenge by the ICO, if it does escalate to that, they're less likely to hold you to account or make decisions any differently, because they can see your maths, essentially. They can see that calculation.
Well, yeah, thank you, Laura. Thanks for stepping in.
That's all right. Anytime.
We'll bring you back at some point, I'm sure. Maybe for a full session. Is that you fading into the background now?
That's me just walking off.
Yeah. So, Jo, you did a little bit of work this morning, didn't you, on considering the principles and how they impact people's rights?
Yeah, I did. And it kind of came off the back of not really understanding how to kind of, you know, build a session on part two, because I thought we did quite a good job in the first part, but you were adamant on a part two.
You're making this such a thing when it's not.
So I kind of went through and kind of just looked at each principle and how those following the principles as an organization can impact the amount of SARs or rights requests in general that you might get. So I think this is my opinion, by the way, this is not like fact, but I kind of wanted to kind of have a conversation, and, you know, by all means, if you disagree or agree, or I've not thought of something, please do get involved in the chat. But I guess I think it might be worth just kind of going through the principles and how I think that they might impact your, you know, the amount of rights requests that you get. So I guess if you go to lawful, fair and transparent, I think lawful processing may provide you with ammunition to refuse erasure requests and objections to the processing. I think fair processing means that the processing is, you know, what the data subject would expect. And again, this is probably likely to reduce the number of objections that you get towards processing. I'm not saying it's going to completely stop it, but, you know, it could pull it back. And obviously, I think transparency helps meet Article 13 and 14. You know, if you have a clear, if you clearly specify in your policy what you do and why you do it, you're more likely to see a reduction in subject access requests, possibly.
Yeah.
And as SARs are for you to understand what data a business hold on you and why, could having a succinct privacy policy also reduce this as well. Moving on to purpose limitation, I think this would probably cause less objections to the processing and subject access requests. Because, you know, you're using the data for what you specifically stated you would, and I think it's less likely that data subjects would then, you know, have issues around the processing. I think data minimization would be less erasure requests, simply because you're using less data, you're only using the minimal amount of data required for the purpose of the processing. And if someone was to put an erasure request in, then you're probably more than likely going to be able to refuse those requests, obviously depending on the process in itself.
I think on that one as well, you're less likely to get disgruntled people who are saying, you know, why do you have this information and whatnot? And, you know, they'll probably understand if you're only collecting what you need and they're aware of that, following, you know, the yeah, fairness and transparency and everything, then, you know, they're less likely to question what you're doing with their information and why you have it.
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah, thanks for that, Jasmine. Moving on then to accuracy. If you have good practice for data accuracy, I think then you're less likely to receive rectification requests. I think that one's, you know, quite an obvious one. I know it's not always up to you, is it, from a data controller perspective, to kind of keep things up to date. I mean, take for example home addresses, you know, it's quite difficult for you to stay on top of where your data subjects are moving to, but I guess you could have practice in place, couldn't you, where you reach out every couple of years and say, you know, this is the address we have on file, is, you know, is this accurate? But I think having, you know, good accuracy kind of practices would definitely reduce the amount of rectification requests. And then I think storage limitations is probably the biggest one, isn't it, around kind of like retention, because I think, you know, the amount, reducing the amount of data that you have will reduce the amount of data that you have to sift through when responding to a subject access request. And if the data is kept for a minimum amount of time, also you can justify why you need to keep the data for the specified amount of time, which will then allow for easy refusals of erasure requests as well. So yeah, I think you did integrity and confidentiality, didn't you, I believe?
Yeah, so I took a little bit of a different stance with this, which is why we got into the conversation, which we spoke about earlier, about, you know, the wider fundamental rights that, you know, underpins the GDPR and data protection legislation. And with integrity and confidentiality, you know, that's essentially security. And if you've got appropriate access controls, encryption, password protection, policies and procedures, etc., then you're less likely to breach, you know, people's information and reduce the amount of breaches that you have, which, you know, in essence or in effect then preserves people's right to privacy by maintaining confidentiality of their data. And less breaches will also lead to less SARs as well, because, you know, as we were saying earlier, it comes down to disgruntled people a lot of the time when people put requests in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that, Jasmine. Now, we are on the verge of running out of time, but there are 4 minutes left. So I think I've got a nice little filler to kind of just fill that gap. And I've mentioned it before, I think, when we've done episodes on rights requests, but there are two different types of rights, aren't there? You've got your qualified rights and then you've got your absolute rights. And I want to just talk about absolute rights and what they are and kind of why it's critical to kind of get it right to begin with. So as I explain, hopefully it'll make sense, but the two absolute rights are the right to withdraw consent and the right to opt out of direct marketing. And what absolute rights means is that you can't argue or you can't refuse the request. You know, they are what they are and you have to fulfill the rights request. So the right to withdraw consent, I think it's quite straightforward, isn't it? Once an individual withdraws their consent, you must no longer process that personal data. And this is why I think it's critical to apply, you know, the most appropriate lawful basis in the first instance, because if you rely on consent and someone withdraws it and you're like, oh my God, I need that data to, you know, pay him, for example, then, you know, you can't do that anymore because they've withdrawn their consent and you're just kind of stuck in a rock between a hard place, aren't you? So I think that's why it's so important to get the lawful basis right first time. And I think something that I ask myself, and it's not always going to apply, but kind of if I'm kind of like stuck between legitimate interest and consent, or, you know, contract, for example, a question I ask myself is, okay, so if we want to process this personal data for the purpose of payroll, for example, what would happen if we relied on consent and the individual withdrew their consent? What would this mean for the processing of the data, and what would the impact be? Now, the impact obviously would mean that you can't pay that person the money. So, you know, consent wouldn't work. And I know it's obvious that, you know, to us anyway, that consent wouldn't work for payroll. But I think it's, you know, a worthy exercise of kind of going through. So if you're a little bit unsure around, you know, do we rely on consent here, just ask yourself that question. You know, what would happen if we relied on consent and the individual withdrew it? Would we be able to carry on our processes, our business processes? Or would it have real implications on not only us, but also the data subject? And if the answer is yes, then consent's probably not the most appropriate. But yeah, I just kind of wanted to make that point. And then the right to opt out of direct marketing, again, is the second absolute right. And I think this one, again, is quite straightforward, that if an individual opts out of direct marketing, then you must stop sending them direct marketing materials. You know, this obviously doesn't mean that you can no longer send direct marketing materials. It just means you can't do it to this specific individual.
Yeah, I think it's really important on that second one. Well, on both, actually, to have measures in place, you know, to record these rights requests to make sure that you don't, you know, continue processing or continue sending direct marketing, and really, you know, treat it as your Bible, really, and be careful.
Yeah, and also just bearing in mind, if someone does opt out of direct marketing and then puts a rights of the right to erasure in, because, you know, they're like, where have you got my information from? Why are you sending me direct marketing? Just bear in mind that it's worth keeping record of, you know, as you said there, Jasmine, that they've opted out of direct marketing, and also that they've opted out of erasure requests. But, you know, you're allowed to, aren't you, keep a record of that. So it's not erased data completely, just minimal.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe. Well, with that, we are on the hour. Thank you, everyone, for bearing with us, for joining us for another week. It's really appreciated. I'm sorry I couldn't keep up with the chat or put my camera on today, but it's been a good session regardless. And we'll be back next week for a GDPR radio session. But in the meantime, we hope you have a great weekend and enjoy the sun. I know I will be. And yeah, thank you for joining again.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. Have a good weekend.
See you later.